Okay. In order to make an anniversary like this successful, it takes a lot of people behind the scenes to prepare the food, to buy it, buy the plates. Otto and Rocky went out and bought the plates and the cups, and a lot of people to set up chairs and behind the scenes, the tables. So Rocky and Otto played a part in the early stages of finding stuff for the food, and Jen and Dennis were here some long hours today getting the ovens hot, and Mary came later, and Jim just happened to be up here from Dorchester to go to, we went to a mass for Freddie, and he got caught cutting the rails. He was put to work. All the people that brought the food, that donated the food, the soda. Jimmy came in early today and made the coffee and set up the table over there. So a lot of people is responsible for putting on an event like this. And then in order to have an event successful like this, you've got to have people. And of course, we've got people from far and wide here, as we do every year, the anniversary. We can go up to the north of the Hatfield and Northampton area, and Stanley and Bernie is here. Bernie's got 42 years of sobriety. And then we can get down to Newton. John is here. Linda. And up at the Parma, see John and Evelyn. And up into the Gardner area and see Roland and Ann and all that gang that have great appetites. It's really good. And of course, Irish Pot. When you know that Irish Pot is coming, you've got to add to the menu. And then you've got the gang in the front row here, Leon and all this gang from up in the Orange area. And I was very disappointed at the Orange anniversary this year. They didn't have any beans. They said a low budget. Low budget. Blame. We always blame somebody.
Yep. We got blame.
So we have a big variety of people here tonight from all over the Commonwealth, from Worcester County, Birmingham, that's running for governor, and about all that gang would have a picnic here tonight. Shaking hands with people. But this is what makes the program work. It's people. And it's great to have people come to anniversaries like this to help us celebrate. And it's been a lot of years that we've been together here in this hall. And on Sunday night, for those of you that don't know about it, they'll have another nice anniversary down in Webster. But we had that breakfast first up in the Wood Point Inn up in New Hampshire first. So you got to put all those things on your schedule. If you're brand new, stay the hell away from people that don't carry a date book. So they'll screw you up. They're tied up with people that know where all the anniversaries are and breakfasts and dinners. Because you can operate on a full stomach and feel at peace. Now we'll call upon Ralph. We've gone way over the line to bring in Ralph from Northville. Northville, New York, I think.
Thanks. My name's Ralph. I'm an alcoholic. You wouldn't have to worry about hearing the same story between myself and Donna, because they couldn't be any different than what you're going to hear, with a few exceptions. One is the underlying things, the things underneath the drinking that brought us here. Those are the same. Just the stories are different. She said she got sober at 20. I wasn't even in trouble at 20 years old with booze. My first drink, I think, was 19. I came from an alcoholic home, and my father was a drunk. He never got the program. He sat behind the post and never really got into it. He liked cards and things like that, but this is my story. And we went out, there was four of us, and we got a six-pack, and some of the older folks here will remember, and a pint of Four Roses whiskey. And we drank that. And I never drank before. I was 19, never had a drink before. I didn't know how much you should drink, you know, the fact that you should pace yourself or anything. And I wolfed it down, and I threw up. And I, you know, that was no fun. I had a nice sweater and, you know, messed it all up and down the door of the car. And I failed to see anything fun about that at all. And I didn't drink probably for another, I don't know, 6 or 8 months or so. I went to the Army. And I drank a little bit then, and I was 20 years old then, and take it or leave it. There's a lot of controversy about whether or not you're born alcoholic. To me, that doesn't matter, as long as the path here is found. If it happens to be that way, that I am an alcoholic, which I am. But I could take it or leave it, and I got drunk, but I could laugh at the hangovers and shake them off, and, oh, you know what you did last night, Ralph? Yeah, wasn't that funny? Ha, ha, ha. That'll change later. But, you know, it was a situation where it just didn't seem to matter. You know, if I didn't have any money in the Army, I didn't drink. And there was no craving. There was no, you know, 2 weeks to payday, and then I can drink. And I had any of that. And I got out of the Army and went to college. And same thing there. I was a veteran. My parents couldn't afford to send me to school. I went on the GI Bill. My father had been bankrupt, I think, 2 or 3 times at that point in my life. Directly because of drinking. Lost his license in 3 New England states. I got out of the Army in my second year in college. They moved to New Hampshire. I was in Connecticut. And I had to find a place to live. I was at the University of Connecticut. So, you know, there was a lot of things going on. But I at that time, I was not hooked to booze. It just didn't bother me. Drugs weren't around, so I didn't have to worry about that other than cigarettes, which I used. That went on. I graduated from college, came up here to Massachusetts. I got married in college, and we had one child when I graduated. Came up to Massachusetts, started my career with Raytheon, and I see some Raytheon faces out here. Seems to be prevalent there. I should have tried some other place in my career. Right. I started out there, and found myself getting very anxious and unsure. When I had to make a decision, I'd run up to my boss, is this okay, you know, I want to do this, and I was getting very, very anxious, and I didn't understand what was happening to me. And I think it was about 1967 or 68, I was asked, a couple of guys had left Raytheon to start their own business, and one of the guys called me, and he said, I'd like to meet you for lunch. So I knew what he was going to do, he was going to offer me a job. And I had trouble traveling, and I was just nervous and anxious. And I got up to the place that I was supposed to meet him an hour early. And I went to the bar, and I had a couple of beers, and everything just settled down. And I said, well, this is what you do, you know. When I don't feel good, when I'm wrapped around the axle about something, all I got to do is have a couple of drinks, go get drunk, and everything will quiet right down. Well, I've come to learn later on that that's an illusion. You know, that's only masking the problem. That when I drank from then on, things seemed to be under control. Things seemed to be acceptable. Unacceptable things seemed acceptable. And, you know, that was the alcohol. But that didn't happen for some time. I think I was probably 33 or 34 years of age when I started to rely upon alcohol to help me deal with life. And I guess that's the point where I stepped across the line and became an alcoholic. And right around that time, I went to a psychiatrist in Worcester. And he saw me 3 or 4 times, and he said, you have anticipatory anxiety. $150 was a big word. He said, I'm going to give you a prescription that'll help you, and it was Valium. 5 milligrams of Valium every 4 hours, or I forget what it was now. So I started taking that during the day, and then I would drink in the evening when I came home from work. I would have my martini or two, silver bullets, you know, and some wine with dinner and beer afterwards, watching TV, and every night that, take the pills during the day. And we went down to Connecticut. I remember one time to visit some relatives, and my brother-in-law is a dentist. He's an MD, so he could prescribe. So we were yakking, and I told him I was taking Valium, 5 milligrams. And he said, geez, he says, don't pay all that money. I'll get you a jug of what. I'll get you a car. He says, there's a thousand in there. I thought he could walk on water. And he said, but they're scribe. You can cut them in half. Right, sure. I'm counting one hand how many I cut in half. Now, there's the thinking was, if 5 milligrams is supposed to help me, then 10 milligrams will help me more. That was the thought process. So that, I didn't know anything about alcoholism, even though my father was an alcoholic. But I realized that that type of thinking is clearly addictive thinking. And I do that with brownies too, but I've never been stopped for that. So that went on, and then it went to Librium and Nisium and Adium and, you know, these different things. And but the drinking was picking up. It was becoming more and more. I was relying upon it more and more. I can remember I had an awful hard time going out for business lunches. And I don't know what it was, I just got very anxious and sick to my stomach, and as soon as I get that first martini in me, every single time. And I began to look forward to that. As soon as I could get that drink down, then I could do business and everything is under control. And that progressed into a lot of different things that I can't even begin to think about now, like the alcohol would last about 4 hours for me. I would come home, have the martinis, wine, beer, go to bed around 11 o'clock, and I could open my eyes in the middle of the night and I could tell you within 5 minutes what time it was. It would be 4 hours after I went to bed. Now, maybe that's something there, like they say, take the pills every 4 hours or whatever, that it just seemed to wear off to the point where I woke up. And it came to the point where I woke up and my stomach would be, it felt like it was jumping up and down. I looked down, it wasn't, but just inside, I was just all riled up and my hands were shaking And I would start drinking in the middle of the night. I go down and slide a beer down. I like booze, pretty much any kind of booze. I didn't like scotch and rum, but that's all I had. You know, I liked it. And so I would go down and get the beer and go back upstairs quickly. I'd have to really wolf it down because my wife was in bed. I am married still, fortunately. So I'd get back upstairs. Went to the bathroom, put some toothpaste on my tongue so that she wouldn't smell it, get in the bed, put my back to her, and try to go to sleep. And most of the time I did go to sleep, and then you wake up with a heart again. You know, 4 hours later, now it's time to get up and go to work, and all this business starting all over again. And I just kept doing that night after night, and the beer, I was having to drink more beer than it was almost possible for a short amount of time so that my wife wouldn't wake up and find out what I was doing. We had a trailer in Maine, and the walls are about this thick in the trailer, really thin. And I got up one morning, it was about 5 a.m., the damn birds were singing. Jesus, I hated that. when those birds started singing, what it signaled for me was, here's another day that I got to grind it out till 11 o'clock or 11:30 where it's acceptable to have a drink. And I just hated that. I hated the birds in the morning. I love it now. But it was about 5 a.m. She was still asleep, so I very carefully opened the refrigerator, pulled the beer out, and went into the bathroom, which wasn't very far from our bed, but again, the walls were paper thin. And even though, I was caught up in all of this sneakiness, I still had the mind of an alcoholic. I could still think of devious ways to do things, not getting caught. So here I am holding this 16 ounce, never mind 12 ounce, all 16 ounce. And I got to open this thing, which at 5 a.m. will sound like an explosion. So I turned the water on, coughed, at the same time I pulled the tab off. It was a big cough. Then I could put that down, threw a paste on the tongue, out the bed, roll up. I was so tired from this stuff. But then I got into vodka. Because that was a trigger hit. I'd get downstairs, I'd take a water glass, a little bigger than this, and I'd fill it about that much vodka and a little bit of orange juice, to cut that a little bit, because a warm vodka is like drinking tacks, thumb tacks, you know, just a little sound so rough. You know, I wasn't eating a whole lot in the days. I think when the stuff landed, it splashed in my stomach, and empty. But that was the hit that I needed to get back up to bed, and also face on the phone, back to my wife, and go to sleep. And she caught me one morning. It was about 5 a.m. The sun was just coming up, and I'm standing there looking out the window, and she said, "What are you doing?" Had a little break. The woman wasn't very happy about that. So she read me the riot act, and then I would shape up for a little while. I wouldn't get drunk for a while. You know, I'd moderate as much as I could. And if we were going out to a party, I would rehearse. You know, I'd practice. Warm up the joints, have a few drinks before I go. Then when I went there, I wouldn't have to have as many to get where I wanted to get, so people wouldn't notice that I was going over to the bar tour. And one of the things that happened to me when I drank was my tongue got about this big around, and I couldn't pronounce words. And I got to, we'd be at a party, and my knees would, like, a wobble. I get myself up against the wall and get my knees locked in, you know, leaning against the wall, and somebody would, right. That would be a conversation. Next guy would come up and talk about something totally opposite.
Right.
Because I was working for a company in Waltham, and I ran a project for them which, for some ungodly or some unknown reason, went off on time and within budget. So we had a big party, and I had about 5 martinis before we ate. And they introduced me to stand up and say something about the party. My wife says, "How much have you had to bet?" America's favorite excuse is the bartender has a heavy hand. They must be using 90 proof instead of the all these excuses, you know, about. And we'd go on vacation with people, and I'd be hungover, and I'd tell them the reason is, you know, "Would you like some breakfast?" "No, no, I'm not much of a breakfast man. I think I got too much sun yesterday. Sunstroke, all this. I missed work, always on Monday," things like that. But that's what it was like. And it sounds funny now, but it was absolutely horrible. I have never, ever felt pain like that in my life since I've been sober. Just the urgent need to have that handy. The frightening thoughts that I might run out. I stopped drinking on business trips because I'd get on the airplane and I'd have one or two drinks, and that would make me more anxious than if I had nothing. And that I should have been able to figure something was wrong when not drinking was better than having just one or two. I couldn't see that anyway. So we went to our trailer one Memorial Day weekend, 1984. And my wife went over to have coffee with some of our campground neighbors, come back at about 8:30 or 9 o'clock in the morning. I was on my hands and knees on the floor. I couldn't stand up in the trailer. And she said, "That's it." And we went home, and she said, "If you don't do something about this, you're going to have to get out." So she called my two oldest sons, and they took me off to Doctor's Hospital. And I met this guy there who used to pick up cigarettes for us, Mac. And he'd come around every morning, and we'd pay him our money. I was smoking straight Camel, and I picked up to 3 packs a day when I quit smoking, no filters. I had to do that, a lot of coffee and things like that. I had no idea what I was getting into. I had been exposed to AA only a little bit because of my father. I knew it was there, but I didn't know what they did. I thought it was a bunch of old gray-haired people. Oh, my smoking cigarettes, you know, and telling jokes. You know. I thought it was some sort of a cult or whatever it was. I didn't know anything about it. And I came in, and what an incredible education it's been. I found out so many things about myself. I thought I knew about alcoholism. I can remember lecturing my father, saying, "You don't know how to drink. Every time you drink, you get into trouble. Can't you see that? You've lost your life in the city. You've cracked up cars. You beat up my mother. All these things. Can't you see what alcohol does to you? I can remember lecturing him, and that was half in the bag at the time that I was working there. He was a binge drinker. He would go off. He was sober 10 years once, and then he'd go off one or two where he'd be blind, absolutely blind for about a week. And I was a daily drinker. I could have my cocktails, and a lot of times I didn't get drunk. I just got a buzz on, and that was it. And it wasn't causing any problem. I didn't crack up any cars. I didn't. Well, I never beat my wife. One problem is she swings back, right? Give her an idea. Coordination being off and all that. I asked this guy, finally got up courage after about 3 months. This guy would be my sponsor, and he said, no. I gotta do this again. And I asked another guy, and he moved out of town, and I went back to the first guy I asked. Happens to be Ron of the Ron and June combination. I'm sure some of you people know them. And Ron's still my sponsor today. And then he said yes this time around. And my first sponsor said, I think you should go to one step meeting a week. And I had no idea why he said that. Because I don't know. I remember being in Doctor's Hospital in the basement conference room, and the banners were back there. And I would look at those steps. They didn't make any sense to me. And I just didn't understand it. So I didn't go home anyway. I went to one step meeting a week, and everything started to snap into place. My wife told me she had no feelings for me at that time, absolutely none. But she did let me come back and live at the house. So I had we had six kids. Okay, one of the kids is Down syndrome, and he was born, and I was still drinking, so I drank my way through that. 11-year-old daughter died in 1974. From brain cancer. I drank my way through that. I even tried to convince my wife we shouldn't have a big funeral. You know why? Because it's going to be a long time without a drink. Mm-hmm. That for but a low level that alcohol can take a person to. Well, I'm very proud of that, but I've resolved that at her gravesite. Anyway, I got into the steps, and I learned a lot of things like resentments. You know, what they can do. And I never thought of resentments. I always thought that I'm upset with this person because they're wrong. But I never thought to be open-minded, and he's merely got a point here. Maybe I should listen instead of acting all the time. And I would have arguments with my wife, and I'd always try and out-talk her. I'm a little bit faster in the head than she was, so I could always be a few jokes ahead of her. And so I'd go through and make all my points, and she'd finally get sick of trying to compete with me. She'd do a climb out. That drove me nuts. She'd go quiet. So we would have these arguments, and maybe I'd go out of the room and go upstairs. I think of something else. So I come back downstairs, and another thing. You know, crying it on, and I learned that it never got me anywhere. You know, that behavior never got me anywhere, but it always seemed like I thought it did, or I thought it would. Sanity, like taking a drink, I never got me anywhere. So I learned that I can be upset with people from time to time for, a day, half a day, maybe 2 days. But if a week from now I'm walking around and I'm writing a script in my head, I'm writing this play, that when I see this person, I'm going to say, you should have done it. That was not true what you said. And it wasn't three, it was four. And I'm really going to convince this person that they're wrong and I'm right. And they'll see my point of view. That's a resentment. When it's eating me up, and every time I don't have something else to occupy my mind, that snaps in. So it's kind of like a hole, You dig a hole, you put your hole in the sand, and pretty soon all the sand falls in. I have to be replaced by something, just like thoughts. I can't just stop thinking about something. I have to replace it with something. So I learned that resentments are very, very dangerous for me and very harmful and use up a lot of useless energy in my mind. So I was able to start dealing with that kind of thing. And I learned about acceptance, that when things aren't going the way I want, to hopefully not put the bulldozer blade on and try and bulldoze through something, but to say, well, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm going to have to accept it. Now, I've learned, I always thought a lot of things in AA that if you get on your knees, the problem goes away immediately. You say, I'm going to accept this situation, and all the bad feelings go away. I'll work the 12 steps and I'll feel good for the rest of my life. Nothing will ever upset me. I almost thought that, and turn it over. I'll turn this over and it'll go away. Well, most of the time that's not the case, at least in my experience. What I found out that, first of all, acceptance isn't approval. It doesn't mean that I approve of what's going on. It means just that I accept what's going on, and I'm just going to have to let it go its course. There was one other point about that. I forget what I was trying to say, but stop struggling. You know, acceptance for me is stopping the struggle. Where a lot of times, like going upstairs and thinking of one more point that I have to make, or the next morning maybe making a point before she's even awake, and she wakes up like a cobra, you know, ready to strike. Certainly not the best time of day. She's not like that now, but you know, she was trying to put our marriage back together too. Next year we'll be married 44 years, so things can turn around. And it's just so many things that I've learned, dependence on God. You know, God is a very, very important, my God is a very, very important part of my recovery. I pray every single day, and I pray especially for people that are struggling, and I don't want to ask them anything for those people other than to bless them. I don't say, take their cancer away or do this, because then I'm playing God. This is just my thoughts. That I ask God to bless them, and figuring that he's smarter than I am, he'll know what to do. And I don't have to ask. Just ask for God to bless them. And I do that for people that I can build resentments towards, too. There's some people that I just don't care for. And I ask God to bless them. And, whatever that means for him, then he can go do it. And it's been quite a journey for me, learning how to live outside of AA. You know, to get inside the room to, think about all these things and go out the door and somebody cuts you off. That was the problem. I was sober, I think it was maybe 7 or 8 years, maybe 10 years, and I was going down 290 and somebody came by me, I guess I did something wrong, they tooted his horn, and my arm and finger flew up out of reflex. There was no thought behind that. I looked to make sure it was my own arm. It was incredible. And I was really embarrassed about that. Like I shared that at a meeting. I really felt bad that I had stooped to that level to do that. The old behavior is still there. And I think the biggest thing that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, almost 18 years ago at the end of this month, is that alcohol was only a symptom. My use of alcohol was only a symptom. That there are a lot of things underneath the surface trough of things that are making me behave badly or drink or whatever. Fear is a terrible thing. Most of the time it's an illusion. Mark Twain said, I'm an old man, I suffer through a great many problems, but most of them never happen. How many times that I have particularly bite my handicapped son, if he's late coming home on the van, they're stuck. They had an accident. Oh no, they didn't have an accident, they left him behind. And he doesn't speak too well. And all these things go through, and then the van drives in the driveway. They never left him behind once. I have no reason to believe anything like that. But the illusion, fear is an illusion. Just starts things going in my head. And I start to waste all this energy. It's total waste. But it's almost a knee-jerk. I just do it out of reaction. But when I'm thinking clearly, then those things don't get to me. And it is a program, for me anyway, that requires constant effort. I have to be alert at all times for situations that will cause me to behave badly and have to make an amend, or a situation that could cause me to drink. And when I ask God to remove anything that's going on with me, or to help me with it, he'll do one of two things. He'll either remove it, or he'll give me the strength to get through it. And that's more often the case. And I haven't had anything so far in almost 18 years that's made me drink. And I can only thank Alcoholics Anonymous. Congratulations to the group on the anniversary.
Thank Ralph and Donna. Wonderful message. And before Otto passes the baskets, we're going to have the countdown. stand up and I announce all those sober 45 to 50 years. 40 to 45. Exercise to be able to get up and shirt that chili. But you guys don't have long trips, so we don't remember the long trip. So from Whiteham, my gang used to go to White River Junction for when old, what the hell was the old guy's name and his wife that used to make, they used to have five different kinds of beans. White River and Windsor. And up in that neck of the woods. And we had an Angela one time. I had a car that had a bump in the back, five of us in the car. And let me tell you, they talk about mustard gas and low water run. I didn't even compare what the beans were made up there in Vermont. So I want to thank all of you for coming here. Now that I have a collection of things on it. Lights and the janitor and whatever else we have to pay for.
It was born right between those two towns, White River and Windsor.
Right with our Windsor, yeah.
Really?
The calling hours for Mike would be Monday, Rosie, 5 to 9. Sullivan or Slattery's? Don't get them mixed up because they're competing against one another. Those fellows. 5 to 8. Okay, at Slattery's in Marlboro. And see, you can do two things that night. You can go over to the calling hours and then end up at the Hudson Second Chance group. They have those chicken hot dogs over there. They don't have 100% pay. Sally buys them on sale at DJ's. You got all the money?
No.
Bring the shirt, all right? The preamble says we're not allied with any sect, with no politics or organization or anything. But if you're from Clinton, we get an election Monday and there's 8 candidates running for selectmen. I'm not going to endorse anybody. And we're honored here tonight to have Nippon. Nippon is one of our town officials. And anybody that's caught in Nippon is a justice of peace, and he's qualified to marry people. He's got some new vestments. And he's got some new vestments, and he's learning to speak Spanish. And he can set up so that you have a catered service. The first wedding he had up underneath the big oak tree in Central Park, right near the fountain, they had a hell of a reception. They had 4 boxes of mixed donuts from Dunkin' Donuts. Okay, we'll close this meeting with a prayer. What have we got?
Our Father, our Lord, 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 our Lord,